Well, Rashi, I have to give you credit. Your presidential bid is growing by leaps and bounds.
I know.
Everybody's aware that you're running for president. Yeah. Everybody thinks it's a great idea. My question is, who are you going to pick as your running mate?
King Kong.
King Kong.
Yeah.
Is he available?
Yeah.
Okay.
He is for me. I made a phone call yesterday.
All right. And so the big guy's coming out of retirement.
He's on his way, Dad. You better clear out the spare room.
Okay. I guess he can wear it as a one slipper or something like that.
Yeah. He's getting to sleep in bed with you. Mama Superica and I are going to a hotel. She said it would be fine.
Well, politics makes strange bedfellows, I suppose.
We have a lot of work to do.
Hi, Paul Dini.
We always go through this. There's like this really pregnant pause between you saying hi and your name.
Hi, I'm Paul Dini. Let me do an AM radio.
Now you sound like Tom Cruise. Paul Dini, Paul Dini, Paul Dini,
Paul Dini, Paul Dini, Paul Dini, Paul Dini.
You guys know that happened to him? He was at a party once and Tom Cruise liked his name so much he said it all night long.
Tom Cruise comes in. Hi, I'm Tom Cruise. And now I'm Scary Squirrel. Paul Dini, Paul Dini, Paul Dini, Paul Dini.
It was weird.
It was weird.
It was really weird.
It was very strange. I was introduced to him and I gave my name and he held onto my hand. Kind of like Crazy Jonathan Winter style, would not let it go. And go, Paul Dini, what a great name. Paul Dini, Paul Dini, Paul Dini, Paul Dini.
Yeah. Paul Dini.
Javier Grillo Marswatch was watching me.
He's another writer.
And I said, and this is my friend, Javi. Let me give you the hand. No, he wasn't done with me yet. Well, nice fellow. And it was about a year from him, you know, doing the trampoline on Oprah's couch. But yes. When he did, I went, aha, now the rest of the world knows. But this is not about me.
No, because Mark Evanier is here.
Yes.
Where is he? Where?
He's right here.
And I have such
I'm always here.
I'm so glad.
I'm like your perpetual guest.
I love it.
Jonathan Harris on Lost in Space. Special guest star every week.
I love it.
You cluttering collection of clanking. Dick Tufeld just passed away. Jonathan Harris would always abuse the robot. He'd say, you nattering nincompoop, you know, some alliterative insult that he'd aim at the robot.
I did a show with Jonathan Harris.
He
was on Channel Umpty 3, a show I wrote and directed. Mm-hmm. And
which we talked about briefly last
The hardest part of doing week. Of working with Jonathan was that all the other actors would start doing him. they would start talking like him after a while. It was infectious. And Rob Paulson was on that show, and Neil Ross, and
Rob Paulson
Greg
is
Berker.
Another Michigander.
And Alice Ghostly was on that show.
Oh, wow. So,
in fact, I'll tell you, you want to ask me a question, or should I just tell you a story? But
tell me a story. I'll put it on.
All right.
I was going to put it on my list, but
all right.
I love it. We'll just segue.
We did this show called Channel Umpty 3, and we were cast. I was supposed to cast the show. I was going to voice. I was one of the writers. I was the story editor, and I was writing. I was voice directing them and writing episodes. And I had to cast the show. Now, we had cast Rob Paulson for the lead character, Ogden Ostrich. We cast a man named David Paymer to play a talking snail in the show. People remember David Paymer for playing, he got an Oscar nomination for playing Billy Crystal's brother in Mr. Saturday Night.
Oh, yes. And yes.
A very fine, wonderful actor. And
yes,
great.
I like him a lot.
We had Neil Ross in the show. We had Greg Berger on the show. And we needed this husband and wife couple. We needed to have this old crotchety billionaire and his wife, who was always putting him down and was kind of nasty to him. The character's name was Stickley Ricketts, was Jonathan's character. So we did auditions, and we picked Jonathan Harris to be the role.
Okay.
And we couldn't really, we hadn't found the wife. We hadn't found the character to play his wife. And I asked the producer, the creator of the show, the producer, a man named Jim George, brilliant man, do you have anybody in mind? I don't know who to have. He said, well, I was thinking of Edie McClurg, I was thinking of Rue McClanahan, and I was thinking of Joanne Worley.
Oh.
I was thinking maybe one of those people. I thought, okay, that's interesting. It gives me a way to think. But I thought, I don't know. You know. So a man named Bob Ridgely passed away. Bob Ridgely was a great voice actor, announcer, on-camera actor, one of the funniest people I ever met in my life. Bob Ritchie, in animation, he was the voice of Thunder the Barbarian. He was the voice of Tarzan. He was a guy who did promos all the time for network shows. People listening to this will remember him for having played the Hangman in Blazing Saddles.
Oh, yes. Wow.
And he played the Flasher in High Anxiety, where Mel Brooks and Costa did the airport. Mm-hmm. And Ridgely was just one of these very funny men. So they had this wonderful, if a funeral can be wonderful, a wonderful funeral for him.
Oh.
And the entire voiceover community was there. Mm-hmm. I go to the funeral, and people are all filing in, and I'm looking over at there's a line of people waiting to get in to sign the book, the little memory book. And in the line are Edie McClurg, Rue McClanahan, and Joanne Worley.
Oh,
not together, yeah. But in one shot, I can see all three of them. And it reminds me, I've got to find a woman, find a character. Oh, before this, Jonathan Harris walks up to me, and he says, "Have you found a wife for me, dear boy?" And I go, "Not yet, we're still working." He goes, "Okay, I need a wife soon." And so then I look over and I see Edie McClurg, just by coincidence, it says Edie McClurg and Joanne Worley and Rue McClanahan. And I think none of them are quite right.
Hmm.
And just then, Sharon Mack, ex-wife of Earl Kress, tapped me on the shoulder and she says to me, "Mark, have you met Alice Ghostly?" And I turn and there's Alice Ghostly, the great character actress.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, "You're hired."
Oh.
I suddenly realized that's the perfect person
mm-hmm.
for the part. And she goes, "What?" I said, "No, never mind. Who's your agent?" She says, "Well, I'm with Sutton, Barth, and Venneri."
Mm-hmm.
Bob Ridgely had been with Sutton, Barth, and Venneri. Jonathan Harris was with Sutton, Barth, and Venneri. Rob Paulsen, the star of our show, was with Sutton, Barth, and Venneri. I look over and I find Cynthia McLean, who's one of the Sutton, Barth, and Venneri agents who's there because it's her client. And I walked over and I said, "Would you feel it very inappropriate if I talked business to you at Bob Ridgely's memorial service?" She said, "No, Bob would love somebody to get a
yes.
job.
Yes.
I said, "Can we get Alice Ghostly for a cartoon?" She said, "Yes, you could." I said, "Can I get some tape on her and Jonathan together?" She said, "Right after the session, if you want to." So she went to Jonathan and said, "Go to the office after the session, after the memorial service, meet me, go to the office." He told this to Alice. I went home after the memorial service, picked up some copy, went to Sutton, Barth, and Venneri, read the two of them together. They recorded them in their booth there. I messengered the recording over to Warner Brothers. Everybody approved it, and we had Alice Ghostly was cast that day just because I ran into her at Bob Ridgely's memorial service.
You found a ghostly at a funeral.
That's right,
yes.
That happened to you.
So,
and I just made a grandpa joke at the end of
yes, that's
story.
Good.
That's pretty
anyway,
bad. Although I didn't ask if she was in a luchador costume, so we get points
yes,
for that, right?
Good.
Like there's something
yes.
to be said for that.
And she was, and the two of them together were so damn funny.
Oh, I bet they were.
They're like
were.
An old married couple. The minute they were bickering in the waiting room before we did the session.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So.
Oh, that's mm-hmm. fabulous. Now you had an interesting story about going to Hartford.
Hartford,
for a
yes.
funeral, right?
Okay, I got a long story here. Settle
awesome.
Down here. All right.
All right.
All right.
I wish we had cookies.
Okay. My grandmother passed away shortly before what would have been her 100th birthday.
Okay.
She was like 99 and 11 months and 2 weeks old.
Oh, she must have been pissed.
Well, she didn't know this. I mean, by the last few years of her life, she was, in the term her doctor used was, happily confused.
Okay.
She was in no pain, but I'd go see her in this assisted living facility in Manchester, Connecticut, right outside Hartford. And it would be like, "I'm your grandson. I'm Mark. I'm Dorothy's son." And she'd go, "Oh, Mark. Oh, it's Mark. Oh, you're such a nice young man. I don't know who you are."
grandson, Mark.
she would hold on to the thought of who I was for about 8 seconds. She could retain it and it would go away. So when she passed away, my mother and I had to go back for funeral and arrangements and, handle matters, things like that. Mm-hmm. So we flew back to Hartford. We got a bereavement fare from Continental Airlines. You can get, bereavement fares?
Yes.
Bereavement fare means they don't charge you the full price of booking last minute because, in other words, You prove to them that you are going for a memorial, a funeral.
You have to supply a death certificate.
Yes, right? You have to file papers, and they will give you a discount because otherwise, you know, to book a flight the day before costs a lot of money.
Right.
Okay. They did have
to talk about it. We fly back to Continental Airlines. We had to change planes in Cleveland, and my mother couldn't eat the food on the flight. She didn't like the food. So, and we were in Cleveland. I went to the lady at the desk. You know, I said, "We've got 2-hour layover here. What's the best restaurant in the airport?" And she said, "Oh, down by Gate 17, there's a Burger King." And I said, no, we've got about 2 hours. What's the best restaurant in the airport?" She says, "Down by Gate 17, there's a Burger King."
Oh, no.
And I said, "That's the best place to eat in the entire airport?" She says, "That's the best place to eat in the entire city."
What?
It's Cleveland, anyway.
Oh, all right.
So anyway, so we get to Hartford, and we get to this Holiday Inn we were staying in by the Hartford Airport, and it's snowing, and we get in about 10:05 at night, and my mother hasn't eaten anything the whole day, and I'm hungry too,
mm-hmm.
and so I say to the lady at the desk at the Holiday Inn. After, you know, she gives us our rooms. I say, "Please tell me that room service doesn't close at 10. And she says, "You're in luck. Room service doesn't close at 10. We have no room service here."
Oh.
You're in luck.
And I said, "Well, where can we get something? We need food." And she says, "Well, there's a Denny's about 8 blocks from here." Well, it's still snowing out, and I didn't want to take my mother out in the snow to get. And she said, "Well, maybe I can go down to the Denny's and get a takeout order and whatever it is." And she said, "Well, you know, we have a bar here in the hotel, and the bar has Pizza Hut pizzas."
Okay.
And I turned to my mother and said, "Will you take a Pizza Hut pizza?" She said, "I'll take anything, sure."
Mm-hmm.
So I got my mother to her room, and I got put my suitcase in my room, and I go into the bar. Now, I do not drink, so I have not been in bars very much in my life. We walk in. This is a sports bar.
Okay.
The waitresses, the hostesses are all overweight women dressed as referees.
Whoa.
in striped shirts with whistles, baseball caps and hot pants on, and
ew,
tall knee socks.
No.
Okay.
Wow.
And I walk into this sports bar.
And you asked, "Is this heaven?" No, I'm kidding.
No.
He just gave
I
me
walk
the look
into
of
this
death.
Sports bar, and I say, and they gave me this, what apparently is a standard greeting: "Welcome back, great to see you again."
What?
Never been here before.
Yeah, I'm kidding.
And I say to them, they say, "Well, how about, can we give you a beer? Can we give you a martini, whatever you like?" And I said, "I'd like a pizza, please." And they go, "Pizza? We don't do pizza."
Oh, no.
And I said, "You don't make pizza?" The lady at the desk said, "You Pizza Hut pizzas." And then one of the girls says, "Pizza? Did we make pizzas? Oh, we have." And they start arguing with some. There's a Pizza Hut thing in the. There's a thing in the kitchen that says Pizza Hut on it, and they explain it. And finally, but oh, the day shift makes pizzas.
Oh.
We could do it, I guess, but nobody here knows how to do it. And somebody says, "Well, Marjorie knows how to do it because Marjorie used to work the day shift." I go, "Well, Marjorie's on her break, so you wait a minute, and we'll give you, you know." And I had a 7-Up while I waited for Marjorie to come back from her break. And I said, "Can you make me a Pizza Hut pizza? My mother and I will split it." And they go, "Yeah, I guess so. Well, yeah, we do it on the day shift. We can do it night time." So, you know, I gave them the order. So I go into my to a phone booth they had there, and I call in my voicemail at home, and I hear this message from my friend Tom saying, "Oh, Evanier, you're out. Well, I guess, you know, you're probably doing something glamorous, you Hollywood screenwriters. You live that glamorous, exciting life. You're probably with some big stars or something like that." And I go, "Yeah, I'm sitting at a damn sports bar outside the airport at Hartford while it's snowing, waiting for teenagers to make me a Pizza Hut microwave pizza." Life doesn't get any better than that.
It's a good life.
Anyway, so we finally got the pizza. Now, the next day, we take my mother we go to the rest home where my grandmother passed away. And it's this very serene, quiet place. And it's, you know, it's like there's all these elderly people with walkers and wheelchairs around. It's like a library. You're afraid to raise your voice. And there's soft violin music playing someplace. And it's a very quiet, serene place. And I filled all the papers, and I tipped everybody who'd taken care of Grandma. And we took her personal effects and things like that.
Uh-huh.
So then for the afternoon, we go over to see my last surviving uncle. My father was in a family that had 9 children, 8 of them have passed away, including my father. Oh. I have all I have left of that family is my Uncle Seymour. Okay. Uncle Seymour is in a rest home in West Hartford.
And is he still around now?
No. No. But okay. Uncle Seymour, and now I have this mixed family. The rest home that my grandmother in was a Gentile rest home. Mm-hmm. The rest home that my Uncle Seymour is in is a Jewish rest home.
Okay.
The Jewish rest home is just like the Gentile rest home, except that in the Jewish rest home, everybody is yelling at everybody else. And there is, it's not just a matter of yelling. There is the pre-yelling and there is the post-yelling. The pre-yelling is, now listen to what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to only tell you once. I'm going to tell this to you, and you're going to pay attention. I'm about to tell you. The post-yelling, after he said the thing 11 times, mm-hmm. is, I'm not going to tell you again. Listen to what I told you. And they're all yelling at each other. Mm-hmm. So we go in to see my uncle, who's very happy there, Uncle Seymour. And Uncle Seymour was about 85 or 88 years old at this point. And it's a little disconcerting to talk to him because he looks so much like my father. Mm. It's like one of those flicker pictures, you know, that it goes back and forth with different angles.
Were they close in age?
They were fairly close in age. Mm-hmm. But if he's at a certain angle, he looks like my father. And he turns slightly, and he doesn't look like my father. And he turns a little more, and he looks like my father. And he turns a little more, and he doesn't look like my father. And
it's like your lenticular uncle.
And Uncle Seymour is telling me how proud he is of me and how excited he is with, you know, my career and things like that. And he's telling me the joy he has whenever he gets to see my name on television. Because half of my name is his name.
Yeah.
And he loves...
His name was Seymour Evanier?
Seymour Evanier, right.
That's a good plan for all of us.
Everybody called Seymour him, Evanier. Everybody called him... And everybody called him Sam, so he's my Uncle Sam.
Oh, but perfect. His name was Seymour. I like him. I'm fond of him.
So he's going on about, when is your name going to be on television again? I want to see your name on television. Now, my father used to love seeing my name on television. And my father would watch... He really didn't care about the contents of the show. He just cared about the credits. He was always disturbed that the show wasn't just a half an hour of my name.
Well, it should have been.
Well, and he was. My father was at his happiest when I did That's Incredible. I did that for three years, and I did about 100 episodes of that show.
Wow!
And when they went put them into syndication, they cut them into 230 half hours. They somehow managed to cut 100 hours into 230 half hours.
How the hell did they do that?
Well, because there were more commercials in the syndicated version,
all right.
And because they pulled off the shelf a lot of segments that we never used and stuck them in. A lot of stuff that got cut out of the show. It only aired in syndication because they wanted to have as many syndicated episodes as possible.
Oh, I'm sure that makes sense.
And in L.A., they ran those shows, the half hours, 4 a day. They'd run 2 in the morning, 11 and 11:30, mm-hmm. and they'd run 2 in the evening on Channel 5 at 6 and 6:30. And my father he loved this because my name was on 80% of them. So it was always on at least one of them a day. So in the morning, he'd make his point of being at the TV at 11, and that the credits were at the beginning of the show. So he'd watch the beginning of the show and maybe see my name, which mm-hmm. he liked. And then he'd turn over and he'd watch the stock market on Channel 22, so he could, you know, he could watch my inheritance go away. then he'd switch back at 11:29. He'd switch back to Channel 5 to watch the opening of the second That's Incredible, and maybe see my name. He'd be very happy if my name was on. And then he'd go out. He didn't care about the show. And then he'd be back that evening. He'd watch the 6 o'clock and the 6:30 things. And my father used to have this idea in his head that I could never disabuse him of, that if he didn't see my name on TV during a given week, I wasn't working. I wasn't getting paid.
Oh.
And I explained to him, no, I get paid for those, you know, months before they do them. I'm not being paid by the fact that it airs. Mm-hmm. It didn't care. He just felt like I had a career if he saw my name on TV, and I didn't have a career if he didn't. So Uncle Seymour was the same way. He was so proud when he saw my name on TV. So we're sitting there talking about different things, and he had in his little cubicle there, this little small apartment he was in this assisted living facility, he had a TV guide. This was back when anybody read TV Guide. Mm-hmm. And he had a large print edition, because his eyes were bad, the large print edition TV Guide. So I start flipping through it because he and my mother are talking about something that didn't interest me. And I happen to see that coming on the air in about 40 minutes is that episode, the first episode of Superman that I wrote for you.
Oh, right.
It says Superman Tools of the Trade, which is the first one I did.
That's right.
And I thought, oh my goodness, here's a chance that Uncle Seymour would not know that I had written that. He wouldn't expect to watch that. And I told him about this. I said, there's a show that I wrote that's going to be on. It's going to be on in about 40 minutes. He goes, he gets all excited. He goes, really? And your name's on it? I said, yes. He says, is it at the beginning of the show or at the end of the show? I said, it's at the beginning of the show, but it's very quick. It's only on for half a second or something like that. He's, oh, we've got to go see this. Come on. And he gets up, he gets his cane, he gets up, and he starts, come on, hurry up. And he starts leading us, my mother and myself, out of this room and leading us through this huge assisted living facility. And it's down this corridor and up this way and back forth. And he takes us into this community room where about 40 elderly people his age, in their 80s, are watching Days of Our Lives on NBC.
Oh, no.
And they're all gathered around the TV watching Days of Our Lives. And Uncle Seymour walks right up to the set and changes the channel. And they all start screaming, Sam, stop doing that. We're watching this. And he goes, this is my nephew, and he's from Hollywood, and his name is on TV. I go, no, it's got, we got like 35 minutes before it's going to be on. And I flip the dial back to channel 4.
Yeah.
And he says, okay. So they all get to watch their show again. And we go over, we take seats in this community room. We're watching Days of Our Lives, and everybody's intently watching whether or not, you know, Heather is going to marry Phil or whether she's going to become a nun or whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever the storyline was that
week. Very important.
Day. Yeah. And they're all watching intensely. And Uncle Seymour is sitting there going, shouldn't we change the channel now? I go, no, we've got 30 minutes before
Love
we have
him.
To. He says, I don't want to miss it. I go, no, don't worry. Okay. So every time a commercial comes on, he goes, no, not yet. Okay. So we're going, now it's like 10 minutes before the show's coming up. He says, I don't want to miss it. I think shouldn't we change the channel? No. I said, promise it. Look, it's on channel 5. This is channel 4. It takes half a second to switch channel 4 to channel 5. We won't miss it. And it isn't even at the beginning of the show. It's like, you know, a minute in or two. I think it's after the first commercial.
It's a teaser or something.
Yeah, there was something like that. Okay. There was like a teaser.
All right, okay. So, so we're watching. And he's going, you sure? Okay, it's okay. I'm sure. Okay. So finally, the credits roll on Days of Our Lives. He goes, now! And I run up and I turn the channel over to channel 5. And some of the people who are watching Days of Our Lives are getting up and starting to leave. And Uncle Seymour's going, no, you can't leave. This is my nephew. We're going to see his name. His name's on TV. You know, you'll see Ebenezer on TV. And they all sit down because they're afraid of Uncle Seymour because he's got he's got a cane and he knows how to use it.
Yeah.
So we're watching the show. And I remember suddenly, I think to myself, oh, I remember how fast those credits are on. These people are never going to see this. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
So I go up to the set. I'm going to stand in front of the set and point it out.
Right, yeah.
All right? And they're all going, and they're watching the opening of the teaser of the show.
Yeah.
And that's it. Now, how long were those names on those shows?
You know, it was like a title card came up, and then the name came up, and then the director's name came up.
Yeah, but it was on for,
you know,
about a
couple
second.
Seconds.
About a second or two.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, so fine. So I'm going, okay, everybody, now, name's coming up. Don't blink. Okay, here it comes. There it is. And then it's off. And they all go, I didn't see it. Put it back.
Oh, God.
And somebody's going, I think I saw it. Oh, what did I say? I think it said Ebenezer. Yes, that's right. It said Ebenezer. And they all started saying to me, why did you leave them on so you can read them? What's the point of putting the name on if you can't read it? And you should see the credits they have on right now, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and Uncle Seymour is so proud. This is like the crowning moment of his life that he got to be there and all his friends got to see it say Ebenezer on the set. Anyway, that's the story I thought you would. I don't know if
I love
told
that,
you that story.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's a great story.
That's pretty great. So how proud of you was he when you were working on the Croft shows?
He was proud of anything I had my name on.
Well, because the Croft shows, that's my lead into the next question.
Well, okay, but you know what? It's interesting. Dennis and I got Dennis Palumbo, my partner.
Uh-huh.
We got our first screen credit and our second screen credit on consecutive days. The first screen credit we got was on the debut episode of one of the immortals of television, the McLean Stevenson Show.
Mm-hmm.
We did not create the show. We wrote like episode 6, but they liked that one the best. They aired it first. So some newspaper thought we created the show. And to this day, I have people asking me if I created the McLean Stevenson Show. And I said, no, I didn't even watch the McLean Stevenson Show. We just wrote one script and got out. We got out like after 4 weeks, and McLean was gone in about 7. So then our second screen credit was the next day on Welcome Back, Cotter. And the next day after that, there were no screen credits at all. And, you know, my father was like, so, you're not working? Then the following week, they ran a Welcome Back Cotter. We were, our credits were supposed to be on Welcome Back Cotter every week, but the following week they ran a rerun from earlier in the season, which we didn't work on. And Dennis's parents called him from Pittsburgh and said, you got fired?
Oh, no.
Anyway, but, you know, people think that that's why the names are so important. Mm-hmm. And you know, the credits on Garfield, you can't even read those Mm-mm. things. So,
no, they just blip by.
And they shove them to the side while they show the preview of the next show coming up.
Yeah.
You have to buy it on DVD before you can read the credits.
I've got them on DVD. I can't read the credits on the DVD. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, I was so proud when you sent that screen grab the first season that I appeared in it, because I just looked at it and it made me think of that one time in the Garfield session when you had both Stan Freberg and June Foray in the booth and you were giving notes to Wally Winger. And to those of you at home who don't know, Wally is not only Mark's John on Garfield, and he's wonderful, but also he's the announcer on the Jay Leno show. You know, and so he's got some pretty big gigs. So he's certainly no slouch. But he was so excited to be, first of all, directed by Mark, because that's a big deal for all of us. Also, to be in the same booth as Stan and June. I mean, he was just fanboying out. And do you remember? Do you know what I'm
talking about? I said, okay, I want to do this scene over with Wally, Paul, Wally, Stan, and June. And Wally suddenly got, like, he was tingling.
Yes.
He suddenly said, my God, I'm Paul Frees.
Yes.
I'm working with June Foray and Stan Freberg.
And then he asked Andy, who runs the booth for you at Buzzy's, which is a place where we record, were you recording that? Were you recording when he said Stan, June, and Wally? Because can you just send me that clip? Yes. just to have my name in the same sentence and getting notes, and oh my God, and he just flipped out.
Well, you know, it's fascinating to me always, and Paul has had this experience, and you've had this experience. Mm-hmm. There's moments when you suddenly find you're working with someone you loved as a child.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're suddenly on the other side of the looking glass, and you're part of that world that you were once a spectator of. Mm-hmm. And when I was working with Dawes Butler, when I was working with Soupy Sales, when I was working with Stan Freberg, with June Foray, with all these people, working with Mel Blanc, with Joe Barbera and Bill Hanna, mm-hmm. You know, it's such a strange sensation. And I'm not so sure that people who are watching TV today, who get into the business in the future, or watching movies today, are going to have quite the same sensation, because I don't think stars today are as special to them, mm-hmm. because everybody's in show business now.
Mm-hmm. And everybody's
there
on.
There isn't quite that dividing line there used to be, uh-huh. between we're the audience and they're the stars. Mm-hmm. Everybody listening to this has probably met someone that they loved on television.
Or at least saw on YouTube.
Yeah.
I'm on so-and-so's Twitter feed, so... You know, my favorite celebrity has a Twitter feed, and I get words of inspiration from him every day or something.
Those two classes, kind of casts, have grown together. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you can go to a comic convention now or an autograph show, and you can meet stars. It's not a signing or whatever it is. It's not that impossible, inconceivable. There used to be that firewall between the audience and celebrities, mm-hmm. and now there isn't anymore.
Yeah. I mean, as a kid, listening to comedy records late at night, and I owned very few of them, because I didn't know where, you know, I was a kid, and I didn't know where to buy comedy records. You know, I would find them occasionally, but never the ones they played late at night were a big mystery to me, because I didn't know where to find them. You know, I'm 9, 10 years old. I don't know how to buy anything. And when they would play United States of America, Stan Freberg plays United States of America, I'd wait all the way till the end gag, which to me was one of the funniest gags I've ever heard. One of the last end gags. They're doing a big wrap-up with a musical number. And at the end, it's interrupted by a knock on the door. And Freberg opens and he goes, yes. And it's June Foray. And she goes, in granny voice, Mr. Freberg? And he goes, yes. And then she switches and he goes, I'm from the Daughters of the American Revolution. And he goes, later, and slams the door on her. And for some reason, I thought that was the funniest joke ever written. I would sit there with my mouth hanging open because it was so quick and so sudden. And I kind of knew that he had pissed off this woman, you know, for making fun of her heritage and everything. And her voice shift was so quick. I just, to me, I thought, they'll never write a funnier joke than this. That, you know, and the whole album is terrific anyway. But it would be inconceivable to me at that age to realize at some point I'm going to work with both of these people. In my, for one thing, the idea that I would work is then the idea that I'd work in cartoons or show business or some even tangentially in that field is like, I couldn't conceive of it. And then the people I would listen to late night on the radio who made me laugh, it would be just like, wow. You know,
yeah.
can't believe it.
I'll tell a story that will only mean anything to people who are familiar with the United States of America. Probably, well, if you aren't familiar with the United States of America, Stan Freberg presents the United States of America. You got to get a copy. It's the it's the funniest historical album ever made and the best, most historic comedy album ever made.
Yeah.
When Stan has been on Garfield, one of the things I do because he's Stan Freberg is I deliver his check to him in person, usually. I take his paycheck over to him. So one day, this happened, and it was one of those moments you'll never forget. I took his paycheck over to him, and he said, oh, thank you. I'm going to run over and deposit it. And I said, you can't deposit that check. And he said, why? I said, Columbus Day.
Oh, my God.
It was Columbus
That's
Day.
Awesome.
Oh, my gosh.
Just worked
and
out.
Stan just kind of did a triple take and laughed for 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so proud of myself.
Stan Freberg is one of the kindest, gentlest souls I have ever had the pleasure of riding around in a car with, of working
You
with
took him home one day, I remember, you from
I
the
did.
Session. Yeah, that was great.
I loved
He's still here. Oh, you meant to his house. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Paul won't let him leave. You guys, this is a cry for help. Yeah. He's scratching at the door in the hallway. We've got to get him out of here.
Save me, I'm Pete Puma.
Did I tell the story on the previous, one of these previous podcasts about working with him on United States of America?
No.
Well,
he's on my, see, he's on my
okay,
list right there.
Okay.
And my really fancy paper list that I made when we were at dinner
good.
The other day.
I discovered Stan Freberg because...
No, just stop. He discovered Stan Freberg, ladies and gentlemen. Man,
that's
discovered,
right. I discovered
I
Stan Freberg.
Stop.
I learned who Stan Freberg was. I first heard his records in, to flashback, on week before last of this podcast, the Soupy Sales Show. They would have Soupy.
Ago.
Soupy would have the puppets. Pookie mm-hmm. and Hippie would mime... I said Pokey and Hoopy. Pookie and Hippie would mime to Stan Freberg records. And I knew those were records. I didn't know what they were, but they were very funny. And my father one time came in while they were doing one of those. And I said, what is that? And he said, I think it's Stan Freberg. So I went to a record store. My parents took me to a record store on Westwood Boulevard on the exact location where Junior's Delicatessen is now located.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
On Westwood Boulevard. And I walked into the man up at the counter, and I said, excuse me, Stan Freberg. And he said, oh, comedy albums, aisle 4, whatever it was. I went over there, and there was a bin of Stan Freberg records. And I bought one.
Yeah.
The one I bought was called Face the Funnies. I bought it because it had mm-hmm. comic strip characters. And
oh, yeah.
It was on that record that not only did I hear all these bits mm-hmm. that, and fall in love with Stan Freberg's sense of humor, but I learned who Dawes Butler and June Foray were. Mm-hmm. There were photos of them on the records. There was a cast. And I listened. And I go, oh, that's the voice of Huckleberry Hound. That's Dawes Butler. And I started looking at credits. And that's why I became aware of who Dawes and June were.
Wow.
Because they were on that record.
So your training started when you were that young.
Yes. So then I went back the next week to get another Stan Freberg record. And I bought United States of America Volume 1.
Mm-hmm.
And I took it home and listened to it. And it was wonderful. And I loved it. And there's June again on that. Dawes mm-hmm. wasn't on that one, but June was on it. And I went back the next week, and it was since that was Volume 1, I went back to ask for Volume 2. And they said, oh, we don't have it yet, but it'll be in one of these days. So I went back to that record shop every week, and I bought all the other Freberg records. And I'm going, when is Stan Freberg Presents Volume 2, United States of America Volume 2, going to be in?
Mm-hmm.
I've got Volume 1, where's Volume 2? Little realizing that I would have to wait 33 years and co-produce it.
Hey,
in
you
order,
made it
in
happen.
Order to have it... To actually have Volume 2 exist.
Was that intentional? Like, or did he like put it out as Volume 1 as a joke?
No,
like,
no. He had written Volume 2 and Volume 3 at the time.
Mm.
They were going to put them out one a year for
oh,
three
wow.
years. After Volume 1 came out, he was approached by the eminent Broadway producer David Merrick about turning it into a Broadway musical. And he signed a contract with David Merrick, and Merrick didn't want Volumes 2 or 3 released.
Oh.
Until they did the musical, which took several years to get into rehearsals, and then he and Merrick fought, and it was called off.
Oh.
But by that point, Freeberg was no longer making comedy albums for Capitol Records, and
It
just never happened.
And one of the things that's interesting about that record, which is true of the old Kid records that Mel Blanc did in the 40s, also for Capitol, mm-hmm. was they had huge orchestras and real orchestrations. Mm-hmm. The music was done by Billy May. This is the most expensive. This is Sinatra's arranger did the music.
Yeah,
work,
yeah, it didn't get any better than Billy
May.
Yeah,
and he had a full chorus and he had a full orchestra. You know, a comedy record, for years, the economics of a comedy record was, we go to a nightclub, Bob Newhart does his act, we record it, we put it out. No
That's
music,
still how it
no
works.
Nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And here's Stan doing a comedy record that had a budget of about 300 times that. And the math didn't work.
It was animated an animated picture on record. All you needed was the drawings, and you could do it as an animated picture.
Have they
picture.
Ever considered doing that?
Yes, there have been a bunch of deals to do it. There have been a couple little scenes animated over the years. They're still trying to put together a deal to do it as a Broadway musical and to do it as an animated feature.
Okay.
And the deals just never quite fall into place.
Hmm.
But Stan finally did Volume 2, and he's talking about doing Volume 3.
I know he is, because he talked
and,
to me about
yeah,
it. And
yeah.
I was like, yes, do it, put
and
me in it.
Yes,
yes,
that's
yes.
Right, yes.
He watched me do that stand-in gig, that script that you had before. I for a long time, I come and I'd like to help Mark with the scripts, because I mean, it's like watching a master class with these people. Like, even before he hired me for the first time, which was a shock and wonderful, but he let me come and watch. And there's really no greater gift than to watch Stan and June and Frank Welker and Wally and Greg Berger. Now, don't get me wrong, it's also extremely intimidating, because you go, my God, this is the first animated series I've ever seen recorded. These people do the script in one take, and Mark says, no, usually two. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, I had no idea, because they run through your script, they get the timing, the jokes sing, and they run through it once. Sometimes you'll keep the entire script they've just done and do pickups, or sometimes you'll just say, start from the beginning and do it right this time. And they do it, and you're done.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I mean, and I really attribute a lot of that to your writing.
Well, no, it's casting. It's
he always says this. He always says the mark of a good director is hiring the best actors, and you can sit back and do nothing. And he's full of shit. Don't listen to him.
If you hire the right actors, a rhesus monkey can direct these things.
It's not true. It's not true, because jokes aren't always understood, and also sometimes there are timing tweaks that you give it, and it just makes copy sing, and it is always collaborative. You always run it. You're very modest. But you always run a collaborative room, and they love
working
with you.
I'm not good at modest. I'm just not good at
God,
modest.
Oh, God, here he goes.
No, Misty, it's hard to do. The first cartoon show I ever voice directed, I had my cast was Dawes Butler, Bill Scott, Frank Welker, Peter Cullen, Tress MacNeille, Howard Morris, Marvin Kaplan, and about three more people of that caliber. And I said to myself, how can you do a bad show with these people?
Mm-hmm.
Not possible.
Yeah.
It's not possible. And you're in a pass, so you have that kind of talent there.
Oh.
You just have to then you have a traffic cop. Okay, it's your turn to talk. And anybody can do that. It's not that difficult.
Oh, you say this.
And
but...
I say this with enormous conviction.
And I hear you. But still... It takes a certain amount of training in your ear to let those people do what they do.
No, it takes leaving them alone. It doesn't take practice to leave.
I have
this theory. I call it the Baskin-Robbins theory. Okay, let's say you went to work at Baskin-Robbins.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now you go at the counter there. You got 31 flavors of ice cream. You got chocolate syrup. You got caramel syrup. You got butterscotch. You got strawberries. Over there, you got whipped cream. You got a bunch of nuts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It doesn't matter how you put them together. It's going to be good. It doesn't really matter. There's no way to put those things together and make it stink.
But there is. And that way would be micromanaging and not letting them do what they do. And that would be a bad director.
All right. Well, anyway.
So, we're both right.
Read that again with more of a Brooklyn accent. Thank you. Okay.
There's your take two.
All right. Anyway. But the...
So Freeberg, Volume 3 is where we left off.
Yeah. I hope he does it. The problem is just that he can't do it for $12. It's a very expensive endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And
to do it right. And unfortunately, Billy May has now passed away.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think almost everybody who's... Except for June, almost everybody who was on the first volume, except for June and Stan, is gone now. We ran around and got everybody we could who was on the first album who was alive to be on the second album. And Jesse White did that and then passed away. He did a little part in it. And Peter Leeds was on the second album, and he passed away since then. And, you know, just, you know, Stan has outlived most of his stock company is the problem. So, you know.
Well, was Corey Burton on the second one?
What?
Corey Burton on the second one?
Corey Burton. Oh, this is, we should tell the Corey Burton story.
Yes, let's tell it.
Stan, Paul Frees did the narration on the first one.
Right.
He did, he was the narrator on the thing, and doing kind of his Orson Welles style voice, but it's not quite, it's really Paul. Mm. It's the same kind of voice he used for the Haunted Mansion
the Stentorian.
At Disneyland. Okay. So voice. When they were putting together Volume 2, Stan asked me to help him cast the thing, and I did. That's why Lorenzo Music was on it and a few other people we worked with. And he said, I got to get, I want the same sound. I want that Paul Frees sound. And I said, I'll get you a guy who can sound just like, I know the guy. I know the guy to do it.
Yeah.
So as it happens, I was casting another cartoon show at the time, and I brought Corey in to audition for it. And I brought Stan, and I put them back to back. And while they were there, after they read the copy for the show, I said, okay, I want to do one other thing. And I told Corey what I had in mind. Corey Burton is a wonderful voice actor and announcer, and he does this incredible Paul Frees. In fact, in the Pirates of the Caribbean and at the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland, which are both Paul Frees voiced attractions, when they have had to change some dialogue because the ride changes, they bring Corey in and he imitates Paul so seamlessly you cannot tell that their new lines dropped in.
Yeah, they do. They go so crazy voice.
Corey in the booth, and I say to Stan, "Stan, I want you to hear something. Remember, I told you I'd find you a guy who could do a good Paul Frees for your narration for United States of America." I said, "This is the guy." And Corey's kind of a skinny guy. He doesn't look like a guy that voice would come out of.
Mm-hmm.
So he starts doing it, and out over the loudspeaker comes this booming, "Stan Freeberg modestly presents the United States of America," you know. And Stan thinks we're playing back the Paul Frees track.
Oh.
And he goes, "Okay, fine, let me hear him now." And I said, "That is him." And then Corey starts reading some copy that wasn't in the original thing, and Stan just went pale. He went, "That's it. Oh my God, that's exactly what we want." And that's how Corey Burton, one of my prouder casting things, and that's how Corey was the voice of United States of America Volume 2.
Well, and I bet he was thrilled.
He was like one of the crowning points of his life, I think, just to,
I would say.
Because he had listened to that to be a part of that record at all. I had a couple of voice actors who were angry at me I didn't put them on it.
Yeah.
They didn't care about the money. They just wanted to be a part of United States Volume 2.
Well, I mean, it's such a huge part of the zeitgeist and their development and the things that they would have appreciated at that time. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's so many things that they would be so grateful for to just be involved or adjacent to that kind of legend.
Yeah.
So that's pretty neat.
When Penn Jillette gets up in front of the Writers Guild and says, "This is the greatest comedy album ever," and everybody else, you know, roars their approval from a room full of writers, you know, yes.
Yeah, that was it's an just it's actually there. Anybody who wants to learn cartoon voice work should listen to that album.
Yeah.
It is, even if it's not a cartoon, it is an example of exactly the best cartoon voice acting skills you could possibly bring to a job. All the Freeberg records are like that.
Mm-hmm.
All of his records, they ought to all be in print. They're not at the moment. They should be because they're so good.
There's a record store up in Carmel called Do Re Mi. Give them a shout out because it's the best record store on the Central Coast. Nowadays, the only record store on the Central Coast. They have a great selection of just about everything. They do have a Stan Freeberg section that, for whatever reason, they always keep that, you know. And they sell them because I always buy them when I go up there if there's one I don't have or a new pressing of it. And they always stock it. And they always have his CDs and stuff up there.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find them if you look. But a lot of his singles, I've given up finding because...
Yeah, just a month ago, I picked up a new vinyl of the United States of America.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Just because had to have it on vinyl. Had to have it.
Did you have that Muppets thing on your site or a link to that just recently? Or was that? Did I see that on your site? Where it was like an old Muppet bit where they were miming to hysterical.
Jim Henson's first TV show was a thing called Sam and Friends that he did for the local NBC affiliate.
They
in
were
Washington.
Like little blobs, weren't they?
Yeah, well, they were little Muppet characters he made, and it was a 5-minute show done twice a day live, and often what he'd do is he would have the characters just lip sync or the equivalent of, what would it be, hand sync? If a puppet does to Stan Freeman Records. And I put up a video. It's on YouTube if people want to search for Sam and Friends.
Hysterical.
Of the puppets miming to Stan's Sacy Bone recording.
Nice.
But, you know, those records were used all... Everybody in the world who had a kids show who did puppets would have the characters mime to Freeburg Records. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's how I learned them on Soupy. That's how Henson was doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's...
back then?
Back then they could. Now, we've talked about Freeburg. We've talked about some of the other voice actors you've had and some of the voice actors you've admired. Have you ever worked on camera or, you know, like adjacent to an actor that you were just like, oh! And have you ever been... I mean, I think what I'm asking you is, have you ever been starstruck?
Well, when I the first time I did one of these podcasts, I told the story about having Groucho
on the show. Uh-huh. Try the whitefish.
And after Groucho, when he came to the set of the show I was doing, it's hard to get impressed by anybody.
Yeah.
You know, it's Groucho Marx.
You're kind of transported to the top of Mount Everest. Where do you go from there?
I worked with Bob Hope on a show. I worked with Jerry Lewis on a show.
Did we ever talk about the joke he wrote?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I worked
That's
with
one
Bob
of my favorite
Hope.
Stories.
I worked with Sid Caesar on a mm-hmm. bunch of the Croft shows I did.
God.
He was like our all-purpose guest
star. The Croft show is my next question, just so you know that we're going there.
And I worked with, you know, I mean, those are the guys who... I can't think of who you'd be. I worked. Here's an interesting trivia question. I don't think I told this story. I did a show one time. We had on the show the man. This was 1981. The man who at that moment was the most famous man on the planet. Now this is an interesting
David
trivia
Hasselhoff.
Question.
No.
Who in 1981? He may still be for all I know. Mm-hmm. But in 1981, this person was the most famous person on the planet. Now that's so you got to guess who that is.
Who would that
Carson?
Be?
Now, and I'll give you a hint here. You have to think about this. In order to be the most famous person on the planet, they have to know you in China.
Yeah.
Okay, so that kind of lets out American television and movies. Mm-hmm. They don't get American television movies in China for the
Michael
most part.
Jackson? I know you
no,
did work with Michael.
I Jackson. Did work with Michael Jackson. He might at some point have been the most famous person. But in 1981, I worked with a man who was the most famous man on the planet.
Okay, so what we would be
so you
doing
have to have, so you have to start. It helps to think of what category.
Yeah,
would he be
it
like?
Would be
well,
somebody
politics.
Who wasn't talking. Would it have been maybe a mime?
No, he was talking.
Okay.
Music, politics. What else is well known in the world?
Music, politics, art, movies.
Can we have
cartoons.
Another hint that doesn't give it away?
Well, if you okay, it's not music. It's not politics. It's not movies. It's a different form of entertainment.
Maybe
writing?
A juggler?
No.
A different form of entertainment. And
what are people famous for in this world? They're famous for being in politics. They're famous for being in entertainment. They're famous for being in what else?
Religion?
No, but that's another category. But okay.
Oh my God, I feel so stupid. I have no idea.
Sports.
Oh!
Okay. Yeah, I was a sports fan. All right. That's why.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Now, what's the one sport they know in every country in the world?
Soccer.
No.
No.
The one sport they know in every country of the world is two people hitting each other.
Oh, boxing.
Muhammad Ali.
That's right.
Wow. No,
of course.
That wasn't coming out of me at all. There
so,
was no way that I was ever going to get there, so thank you for...
Anyway.
Non-superpower people who fought Superman.
They yeah,
know,
there you
yeah,
go. Yeah,
Muhammad
yeah.
Ali.
Yeah.
And before he came on the show, this is on That's Incredible, his advance man came over to... and we had this discussion of how to address him.
The greatest?
Should we call him Mr. Ali? Should we call him Muhammad? John Davidson wanted to call him Muhammad. We thought, no, John Davidson should not call him Muhammad. Mm. You know, and then one of the stage managers, like, I call him Cassius Clay.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and he'll
maybe
love that.
Once.
So I went to his handler, his advance guy. I don't remember the guy's name. And I said, how do we handle this? And he's told me the perfect answer. You call him Champ.
Oh, nice.
How could anybody ever object to being called Champ?
Yeah.
How could anybody ever be offended at being called Champ? And so when he got there, it was like, this way, Champ. Thank you. Nice to meet you, Champ. You know, we all called him Champ.
Nice.
Yeah,
that's a good way
you
of doing it.
I think they'll call me Champ, too.
Yes,
I haven't really won anything, but I'll take it.
Yeah.
You know, for that matter, everybody else can call me Doc.
We had
we
did That's Incredible at the Sunset Gower Studios. We were taping it there at the time.
Uh-huh.
And We used to go to lunch while we were there across the street at Roscoe's House of Chicken and Waffles.
Yes, a fine establishment. Mm-hmm.
And we go there and, you know, a bunch of white guys go into Roscoe's and they treated us nicely enough.
Sure. But,
you know, they were polite. Okay, so the night we had Muhammad Ali, and he was supposed to be there after dinner, and he came before, for the dinner break, for the taping. He came earlier. And so he's going to stay through the dinner break. And the producer comes to me and he says, Jesus, I'm embarrassed that we're going to feed this crappy food to Muhammad Ali. We had terrible meals on that show. The catering was terrible. And I said, you don't mind feeding it to us every week?
Yeah, no kidding.
And he said, well, I don't know. I don't know what to do here. And I thought, listen, I got an idea. Over at Roscoe's across the street, there's a picture of Muhammad Ali dining there. Maybe it's one of his favorite places. Why don't we just take him over there for dinner instead of having him eat the bad food here? So the producer said, hey, that's not a bad idea. So we went up to Muhammad Ali. And he was saying, so the producer says to him, I was staying next to him, he says, champ, we're going to have a dinner break in about 20 minutes. And you have your choice. We can eat with the crew here. And the food isn't very good, but we could go, we were thinking of going across the street to Roscoe's House of Chicken and Waffles. And Ali lit up and he goes, oh, Roscoe's, love Roscoe's. So I was sent to go over in advance to move some tables together because there'll be about 12 of us coming over.
Sure.
So I go over to Roscoe's and I walk in. They go, oh, I take a table. I said, well, I want to move some table. We need to move some tables together. I've got a party of 12 coming in. And this guy there says, party of 12? We don't can't take a party of 12 here. We don't have space for them. You know, I said, well, we can move these tables together. We can ask those people there to move to another table so we can put those together. He says, well, you know, if you want to do it, you go ahead. We're too busy. So I asked a couple of people to move. And I said to them, you'll be very happy you move once you see who's coming in.
Okay.
And they go, okay. And I moved the tables together myself. And just as I finished, door opens up and in comes John Davidson and Kathy Lee Crosby and Fran Tarkenton, who themselves were pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Fran Tarkenton was only like the greatest football player who ever lived.
Exactly. Yes.
And he wasn't even the star of that dinner.
Yeah.
And in comes Muhammad Ali. And the mouths drop open and people are horrified. And the couples that had moved the table looked at me and gave me a thumbs up like, yeah, hey. We're glad we moved for this. Thank you. And we got service like you wouldn't believe. The kitchen mobilized. They were bringing out buckets of chicken and huge waffles and extra food and collard greens. And for the next couple of months when I went into Roscoe's, it would be kind of like, are you alone? So anyway. So starstruck, Muhammad Ali, you know?
That's a good one.
I mean,
that's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a boxing fan, but that man transcended boxing. There was something about him that took it to a whole different level. So that was excited to meet him. I was excited to meet, you know, mostly the comedians I mentioned. I was excited to meet Gene Kelly. I always thought Gene Kelly was the classiest guy in all of movies.
Why was he? Was he classy when you met him too?
Yeah, he was very classy when I met him. I met Gene Kelly about 1971. I was writing for Disney. I was writing all sorts of stuff, mostly foreign comics, but also some special children's books and things. And I would take the bus out to Burbank, not far from here, where we are, and I would go to, in the morning, I'd go to the offices at Disney, and I'd go to different offices, and I'd pick up assignments, I'd hand in my work and pick up assignments, and I'd have lunch with a fellow named George Sherman, who's my main editor there.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the afternoon, I would go over to NBC. I think we have talked about this in a previous podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, poach in the halls and watch them tape Laugh-In or watch Johnny Carson or watch Bob Hope. And one time I'm there in the lunchroom at Disney and Gene Kelly walks by and he says hello to George Sherman. They knew each other and he introduces me. And Gene is doing a new TV show called The Funny Side, which was on NBC for a brief period of time. It was an attempt. Every couple of years somebody says, oh, let's cross a variety show with a sitcom. It was an attempt to put the two forms together, and it was created by Persky and Denoff, the guys who did the Dick Van Dyke Show and Good Morning World and all those shows. And Gene was the star of it, and he was telling us about it. And he said, we're taping it across the street, and I said, oh, I've known a hang poach in the halls there. And he says, oh, come by the taping this afternoon. Be my guest. So after I left Disney, I walked over to NBC, and Gene Kelly had left a pass for me to get in.
How
usually,
nice.
I'd sneak in, which was not difficult to do then. And I sat down. I went in. Gene Kelly was doing a dance number on a table. He was wearing a tuxedo, which was just perfect. He looked great in a tuxedo. Mm-hmm. And he finishes this number.
Wakes up in a tuxedo.
And then they're done with them. And he's got like 2 hours before they're going to get back to us. So he comes and sits down on the bleachers next to me. Oh. And we talked for 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
And the other exciting thing there was he introduced me to the cast, most of the cast of the show. One of the people was on the show. Now when I say this, there'll be people out there who don't know who this is, but there'll be a certain number of people who smile. Was Burt Mustin.
I remember Burt Mustin.
You don't know who Burt Mustin was?
I have no idea who Burt Mustin was.
There's no way to describe who he is.
But it sounds like an 80s cologne.
If I showed you a photo of the guy, you'd go, oh, that guy.
Okay.
So anybody listening to this, if you don't know who Burt Mustin is, Google him, and you'll go, oh, that guy.
Okay.
And he was on the show, and...
he's TV's oldest man.
Yeah, he always played the old man in things.
Not William Hickey, then.
No.
The show didn't last very long, but I got to sit with Gene Kelly for 2 hours. And then at the end of the taping... He says to me, "I'm going down to the Dean Martin show. I'm doing the Dean Martin show, and I'm doing this evening. In fact, he says I'm going to wear the same tux.
Huh?
And you want to come with me? So I walked down the halls with him to the Dean Martin show, and they were doing a sketch, and I gave him a line. He walked into the scene. It was one of these sketches at home where Kay Medford was playing Dean's mother, mm-hmm. and Lou Jacoby was in it, and Marion Mercer, I think it was in it. Anyway, it's like a little sitcom sketch, and Gene Kelly was in it playing himself.
Okay.
And he had an entrance, and he didn't like the line they'd given him for the entrance. So he goes over, and I'm with him, he goes over to the head writer of the show, a man named Harry Crane. Harry Crane was a legendary comedy writer figure, one of these guys who went back to, he wrote, you know, Martin and Lewis movies and things like that. And he was a very famous guy. And that's how I met Harry Crane. And I ended up writing jokes for the Dean Martin show after that.
Oh,
But we were trying to think of a line that Gene could say as he entered. And I said, and I thought this was so obvious that they'd go, eh. But I said, why don't you say, I'm sorry I'm late. It started to rain and I had to go sing in it.
Yes.
And Gene did this line. It was the first line of mine I ever had read on television.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
And a couple of weeks later, some of the jokes that I gave Harry Crane freelance were used on the show. And that was the first jokes I wrote on television.
Congratulations.
But I got to spend a day with Gene. I spent like 2 hours with Gene Kelly just talking about, and it was interesting. Mostly I was asking him questions about... you know, old MGM musicals. Uh-huh. And mostly what he was talking about was his directing work. Because we talked about mostly Hello, Dolly,
mm-hmm.
and a movie he made that I always liked called Guide for the Married Man,
okay.
he directed. Mm-hmm. And he was much more interested in talking about the recent stuff he'd done as a director than the old stuff he'd done as a hoofer.
Okay.
And we talked about Jack and the Beanstalk, especially did for Hanna-Barbera, mm-hmm. and the stuff he did, mm-hmm. his relationship with Hanna-Barbera and stuff like that. And it was just fascinating. He was a very... intense man, very serious about his work.
Hmm.
And
you talked about Anchors Away.
We talked about we talked about all that stuff, but you know, he was very obliging. When I was a kid, when I was actually going to college, which was some of the same time, well, this predated slightly, when I was going to UCLA, I had on Tuesdays and Thursdays I had this gap in my classes. I had a class at 8 in the morning, and then my next class wouldn't be till like 3 in the afternoon.
Okay. Uh-huh.
So I'd hang around the campus, and I'd go into Westwood Village. And there was a place there, it's still there, although it's moved, called Bel Air Camera.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And if I went into Bel Air Camera at that time, there was about a 1 in 4 chance that Red Skelton would be there.
What?
You're saying what? Like...
Red Skelton. Random and specific.
He loved Bel Air Camera. He was a camera nut, and he'd go in there and he'd hang around and tell dirty jokes to people.
That's awesome.
So,
God, no. And the old men tell dirty jokes.
The crew, the people who worked at that were like, oh, geez, Red, thank you. They were fed up with him. They were sick of hearing the same jokes over and over again and monopolizing it. So I'd come in, and I'd go in, and there'd be Red. And I'd say, hi, Red, how you doing? And he would just stand there and tell me dirty jokes, including the ones he told me the previous time.
Yeah.
And he would tell me dirty jokes over and over again. And it would be like this. I'd say, hey, that's great. Listen, can I ask you about working with Buster Keaton at MGM? And he'd go, yeah, he was a nice man, and I was very sad. Okay, so these two seagulls are flying along, and he would tell me,
Gertrude and Heathcliff stories.
There was a joke he told me about. It was a joke about a sack of potatoes. He told me this joke every single time I saw him.
What's the joke?
The joke is this man goes to the confessional, and he's in there, and the priest, and he says, "Forgive me, Father, I have sinned." Uh-huh. And the priest goes, "Harry?" The priest recognizes his voice.
Okay.
And the priest says, Harry, I can't pretend I don't know who this is. I can't believe you're one of our most dedicated parishioners. This is also the cleanest of the jokes that Red told me.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay? Some of them would make Larry Flint blush. Okay. But anyway. So he says, you're the most dedicated, the most decent man in the parish. I can't believe you would ever have committed a sin. He says, well, Father, I have to tell you, I've been married, as you may know, I've been married to the same woman for 44 years, and I love my wife dearly, and I've been absolutely faithful to her. I've never strayed. I've never even thought of I've never lusted after another woman in my life. But we've been unable to have sexual relations for about 40 years now. It's been, and you don't know what that can do to a marriage. It tears apart the seams of the marriage. We become estranged. There's a tension because of it, and there's a lack of affection and closeness. And I've yearned for that above and beyond the touch of her skin. I have yearned so much for just that closeness, that intimacy that comes with sexual relations. And then finally, last week, I saw my wife bending over a sack of potatoes. And something about the way she bent over the potatoes, her posterior was angled in such a way it looked so adorable. And something I felt an urge I had not felt for 40 years. And I was suddenly filled with this ardor, this power. And I couldn't help myself. I turned my wife over and I ripped the clothes off her and I made love to her right on that sack of potatoes. And that is why I have sinned. And I think I feel that I have sinned and I have done something awful. And the priest says, well, that's not a sin, Harry. You're a married man. Sexual relations between your wife, it's a perfectly healthy thing. And the man, and Harry is crying by this point. He goes, no, Father, I have sinned. He says, no, trust me, that is not a sin. And Harry says, you mean we're not going to be thrown out of the church? And the priest says, no, why would we throw you out of the church? And he says, well, they threw us out of the Safeway.
Ah! Nice.
So.
Nice.
That's the joke. And Red Skelton took five times as long to tell that as I just did.
Oh, my God.
And held it much better.
I thought it was very well told.
I would go see, I'd go over and listen to Red Skelton tell me the same dirty jokes every week. Mm-hmm. Or if he wasn't there, I would go over to the United Nations gift shop in Westwood Village. I went over there one time. My Aunt Dot, one of my father's siblings, worked there as a volunteer 2 days a week. She was there Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Uh-huh.
And I went in one time, first time I went in as a visitor there, there was all these little cute little ladies who worked there. And she introduces me to them. And it's like, this is, Sadie Lipschitz, and this is Selma Moskowitz. And then she says to one of the women, this is Carlotta Monti. Do you know who Carlotta Monti was?
Old-time
we both
star.
Just went, ooh.
Okay.
Yeah. You couldn't hear it, but we both went, ooh.
Okay. For those who don't know, Carlotta Monti was the mistress of W.C. Fields.
Mm-hmm.
She was a starlet who gave up her career to basically live with W.C. Fields. She was the one, the movie was made about her autobiography, W.C. Fields and Me, where Valerie Perrine, who of course was so Hispanic, played her. And Rod Steiger played this bizarre interpretation of W.C. Fields. Well, anyway, Carlotta Monti was working at the United Nations gift shop. And I knew who she was. She was so excited that a person in my age bracket knew who she was. This is before the movie had come out, I think.
Oh, right.
And I took her out for a coffee, and we talked. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, I thought to myself, I couldn't get this out of my head. I said, Mark, you're sitting here talking to someone who had sex with W.C. Fields.
Yeah.
How many people in the world had had sex with W.C. Fields you could ever meet?
Well, yeah.
My favorite story that I ever heard, second favorite now that I heard this one, our story that I ever heard about Carlotta Monti, if in fact this is true, was that she was Fields' mistress right up until he died.
Yes.
Right? And the day he died was Christmas Day, 1945, and he loved the rain, and it was clear. It was a clear day in L.A., and she went outside and took a hose with a spray thing and sprayed the window, so he thought it was raining when he died.
Yeah, so to give him some peace in his last day. That's a true story.
Yeah.
She told stories about Fields to me. She kept calling him Woody. That was her nickname. I have no idea what that meant. Woody would do this.
What was his real name?
Bill.
William Claude Duncanfield.
Maybe she called him Woody? Woody?
It was Woody, and I'd have no idea what that meant.
Well, just probably a little
pet. That was a pet nickname, things like that. And she told me one story that I laughed for about 12 minutes. She told Fields wasn't working, and his agent called him up and said, you got to schmooze the people. You know, he says, why don't you go play golf with Jack L. Warner sometime? And Fields said, if I want to play with a prick, I'll play with my own.
Nice.
That was one of the great Fields quotes that never got otherwise uttered in any place. So she was a fascinating woman. So that's what I would do. You know, and at that time, I thought, you know, wow, Red Skelton and W.C. Fields' mistress. So I wasn't very starstruck after that.
I can't imagine that you would be. Where do you go after that? It's like Paul said, you scaled Everest. What's left?
Well, I met Misty Lee. That was very impressive. Yeah. And I met...
Stink up the room with that bullshit.
Well...
But I need boots and a shovel to get out of here.
Anyway.
Well, I think we should go out on that because we've got you next week, too. Is that okay?
Are you going to take the handcuffs off?
Yeah, no.
Oh, all right.
No, and the foot shack will stay on until I decide you're done.
I sure hope that second pizza gets here.
Never be on a show with a magician.
Ever be on a show with a magician. No. Yeah, you'll be withered and faded and still demanding more, I will be. Talking like Yoda, I am. Signing off, I also am. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
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 This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.